Chronologically, the Leopard is the last text in your module. However, we're jumping in the last on the last two occasions we had talked about Nordic Scandinavian modernism, and I'm jumping deliberately to warmer climates. Okay, so although the Prince of Salina remains as the point of focus of the narrative, one of the things we see is how his perspective is constantly held in tension and opposition with other kinds of perspective that populate the novel, Caligari Segadas, for example, but also Tancredi's and Angelica's. So what we have here is, in some way, it's not so much a return to the historical novel as we saw in Stendhal, but we see a kind of new mutation in that form, a mutation that is required in order to embody what Lampedusa is trying to do with the specific problems of Italy, but also Southern Europe, and the story that he tries to weave around the fortunes of one family there. As you can see, that's Lampedusa, by the way, with the dog, who was a very kind of famous dog lover. So Bendiccio in the novel is given a primacy interpretation, and we'll come back to that later. In his letter to his adopted son, he says the dog Bendiccio is a key character in the novel. If you want to understand the novel, you have to understand the dog, or the use of the dog. But you notice on what he says on the top, also in another letter to his adopted son, I can't do a Ulysses. Okay, I can't write after Joyce. So one of the things we're asking today is, what does it mean to be both conscious of literary forms and traditions? He's clearly, for example, Lampedusa is clearly writing in the shadow of not only Stendhal, but also Joyce. But what does it mean to be an artist, to be conscious of those literary traditions, and then twist them around, give them new shapes and forms? What compels that particular original move? So I can't write after Joyce, but I also can't write after Stendhal. I have to use those traditions and ways of writing the novel, but in this particularly new way that will suit what I'm trying to do. That is to say, embody and capture a moment of European history and Italian history that's different to the histories of Joyce, Stendhal, the Nordic modernists, etc. So overall, today we're looking at the relationship between between historical moments, eruptions of world historical events at various parts of Europe at various points in time, and the correspondences between that and the changes in literary forms, shapes, and style. As I say, the historical novel arrives, but arrives in a refreshed new form. One of the things we've looked at, of course, throughout the course of the novel, I've just given you, on your handout, there's a list of examples. I've just given you two citations here, passages we've looked at in some details before in both Barocca and when we're looking at Barocca and Tolstoy, is one of the things that the European novel, if there is such a thing as a trend in the European novel, one of the things that does at various points in time is question the very idea of Europe itself. So what it asks quite often is, what does Europe mean? Is it a continent? Is it a vision of a particular kind of way of life? Does it signify or mean cultural, a certain kind of cultural accumulation? So certain kinds of arts or certain kinds of writing, etc. And quite often the novels, the example of Tolstoy is a telling one. So this is the Shcherbatskys, if you remember, on their trip to Europe. The princess found everything admirable, and in spite of her established position in Russian society, she tried abroad to be like a European lady, which she was not. for the simple reason that she was typically Russian. So Tolstoy, a lot of what is happening in Anna Karenina is investigating this gap between what it means to be typically Russian and what it means to be European. If you remember, a part of the point of those long, interminable passages where Levin talks about land reform and agriculture and farming, etc., is partly that he's trying to tease out this gap. Is there such a thing as being typically Russian, the Russian soul, etc.? Again, a problem that we see repeated in Dostoevsky and Raskolnikov's meditation of the gap between what he can do in Russia and what someone like Napoleon could or did do in France. So what of these authors and their central characters often meditate on is the gap they perceive between this idea of Europe and who they are. So part of the European novel's gambit in the 18th century onwards is to investigate this emerging idea of, at a continental scale, your European culture, European way of life, European norms, European customs, etc., and where they are, they themselves are located. So one of the things we could argue via the evidence of the novels that we have studied is that the idea of Europe often takes shape throughout this century and beyond in opposition to more local or regional identities. A Russian, a Spanish. So when Baroja writes about Madrid, famously, we've looked at this passage many times before, the capital as a city of contrast, it presents a brilliant light in close proximity to deep gloom, etc. Almost European at the center, in the suburbs, African existence like that of an Arab village. Almost European. We'll see characters in the Skylark, for example, in the following weeks, as well as characters in the Atom Station. Think about what it means to be European, but not quite. So the idea of Europe takes shape often in the novels as characters identify themselves as partially or incompletely European. So one of the things that happens in these novels is that they capture an emergent debate about belonging, right? National identity, regional identities, local identities, but also a continental identity. Okay, we'll come back to why. So when I say quite often the genres and the stylistic transformations in the novel form can be traced or linked to historical transformations in the societies, that's really what I'm getting at. What is changing here is an idea of what it means to be both Russian and European, or Italian and European, or Spanish and European. That sense of selfhood is in turmoil. And often that turmoil is captured in the idioms and the stylistic changes and shifts of the novels themselves. So one of the ways that Europe becomes a differentiated category, we'll look at a few representations of that differentiation in a bit, is the difference between what is taken to be the northern and the southern European ways of life. And you'll recognize this. This exists in our own days. Whether we talk of economics or culture or politics and society, there is often a commonsensical explanation about how Southern Europeans or the Mediterraneans are definitely different from the Nordics and the Anglo-Saxons and Germans of the North. There's a North-South debate that's almost a cultural commonplace now. And that really goes back to the 18th century. As you can see, by the time Montesquieu is writing, already the notion of a South, of a European South, is beginning to be articulated. And Montesquieu makes a very influential thesis about an environmental explanation for this North-South divide in Europe. In northern climates, he says, you shall find people who have few vices, a sufficient number of virtues, and a lot of frankness and sincerity. Draw near to the southern countries, you will think you have left morality far behind. That equation between climates and moralities start from the French Enlightenment thinkers themselves. So one of the ways of differentiating Northern and Southern Europe is done along the axes of climate, but also morality. And then, of course, yet another French writer writing a few years after Montesquieu, nearly 100 years after, so you can see the power of that idea. The man of the South, Charles Victor de Montstetten, the man of the South placed like a king of the universe under the canopy of an ever-serene sky, again, going back to that idea of weather, of climate, daily reveling in flowers and fruits, intoxicated not with ideal, but with sensual gratification, has no distant future to anticipate. In other words, Southern European or Mediterranean human beings are not concerned with the future. They're not aware of history because they've been planted in this area of natural bounty. They give themselves up to sensual gratification. Part of these, the power of these ideas you'll see being replayed by Lampedusa in his sketching of the Prince of Salina, who is of Germanic blood, we are told, but of course is Prince of Sicily and is a prince in Sicily and the Neapolitan kingdom of Sicily at a particular point in 19th century, the 1860s onwards, and it's torn between the sensual gratification that he sees or the sensuality of the climate that he inhabits and the society that he inhabits, and his more abstract, what he calls his Germanic or Northern European tendencies of theorizing and philosophizing. So he, for example, gives his life over to the discovery of the stars and astronomy, etc. So in a way, Lampedusa deliberately plays on those age-old, by this time, age-old and commonsensical categories of not just the differences between the geographical and the climatic features of North and South of Europe, but also what you might call the anthropological differences, the man of the South and the man of the North. These two categories become commonsensical. The Northern human beings, figured as male here, behave almost instinctively different to the Southern ones. And these ideas are played out across a whole cultural spectrum. August Riedel, so one of the things that happens in 19th century Europe is the revival of what is called the Italian neoclassical school of painting. And part of what is going on here is a deliberate portrayal of the South along the kinds of stereotype that Montesquieu, etc., have already talked about. So here you see an idealized picture. Riedel is a German painter who lived a long time in Italy. And this is a typical picture of the man of the South, or the family of the South. You can see the sunshine, you can see the sea, you can see an idealized family portrait of leisure, connoting leisure, the man playing his music, of family life, of a particular set of a depiction of plentifulness, food, etc. The sea, the Mediterranean being a kind of central part of this imagination, and light, which is fundamentally different to the North that leads to this kind, it is implied, of a nearly idyllic existence where you don't really have to worry about the future as such, which was what Bonstetten was saying. So the South appears as a zone of calm, of plentifulness, of family, idealized gender relations and family existence. We don't really see, and it's hard to imagine someone like the hunger artist bursting into the scene, for example. Music, arts, etc., etc. So that's one kind of idealization of the South. Similarly, Chauvin, when he paints another picture, this time the sea is not visible here. What is visible is a connotation, again, of a kind of natural beauty that's very different to what, for example, Shelley talks about. When he talks about the Alps, the sense of the horror and the dread of the sublime, the terror that it invokes. This is not a landscape of terror. It's a landscape of a kind of calm, plentiful beauty. On the background, you see a kind of the top of a castle. This is not an industrialized landscape. It is a landscape that looks back to an imagined ideal existence of a society where the feudal lords still look over in a kind of benign patriarchal way over their possessions. That, of course, in some ways is the conflict in this particular novel. What does it mean to be a feudal lord, an owner of the land, at a moment when the very meaning of the land has been is being challenged by these new currents in history, when Garibaldi's red shirts land in the Neapolitan kingdom of Sicily? What does it mean to be a landowner? And a part of the question that the novel asks is, as Lampedusa says in his notes, this question is not seen from the outside as a kind of objective historical inquiry, but is seen from the inside, from the perspective of the landowner in crisis, the prince. But that is another idealized picture, kind of fairly typical of the Italian neoclassical school of presenting an unchanging, bountiful, peaceful landscape overseen by age-old tradition in harmony. However, there's a flip side to this. And the flip side is quite often in Italian neoclassicism is represented in volcanic eruptions that the South, Italian South, is seen to be peculiarly subject to. So Etna, the volcanic eruption in Mount Etna and Vesuvius, for example, become allegories for the primitive and destructive nature of the south of Italy and of the south of Europe. Here is a very famous painting by Gianni, Girolamo Gianni, where he talks, when he captures the moment of Mount Etna's eruption. And this becomes a kind of shorthand to understand, yes, there's one strand of thinking where the European and the Italian South is plentiful, beautiful, charming weather, charming people, strumming on their guitars while they pluck on fruit and fish, etc. But the other side of that, the flip side of that, is to look at this periodic volcanic upsurges that disturb that harmonic picture. So the paintings of volcanoes become particularly popular in the Italian neoclassical school, connoting a certain kind of primitive outburst, passionate, unpredictable, destructive, of not just the southern landscape, but by extension, within the southern people as well. Again, a stereotype that Lampedusa, the Prince of Salina himself, will sort of replay in his own mind while he thinks about his land. The unpredictability, the harshness of the land and the people, their sheer innate destructiveness. And finally, another influential stereotype of the South, as Francesco Hayes's painting shows here, is the heavily eroticized image of women and the consonant gender politics that goes with it. That entire section in the middle of this novel, Love at Donna Fugata, for example, plays on this idea of the excessive sensuality of not just the southern man, but the southern woman, which is why Angelica becomes such an important figure in this particular novel. It's not just floated by Lampedusa, but also slowly interrogated and deconstructed throughout the course of this novel. The idea of Angelica being a kind of version of that, the woman looking out, waiting, longing with the scene, the background, connotations of luxury here, the richness of the carpet and the pillows, the semi-nude figure of the woman. The implication is that she's waiting for an absent lover who's about to arrive. So a heavy eroticization of women, but also of gender relations, become a part of the way of looking at the South. Now, what obtains at the level of the continent That is to say, the European South, sensual, not really bothered about work, not really looking to the future, enjoying the fruits of the present, heavily eroticized, etc., also obtains at the level of the region. That is to say, within Italy, this division between the north and south of Europe is replayed as a version. Anybody who's familiar with Italy will know this, how powerful this idea is today. The division between north of Italy and south of Italy as basically two different countries, two different regions, two different ways of life. Jen Schneider's article, which this is on your handout, which she spells this out. In Italy, the southern question, the title referring to a very famous long essay by Antonio Gramsci, the Italian communist in the 1920s, which we'll come back to in a second, evokes a powerful image of the provinces south of Rome as different from the rest of the peninsula. One of the things that happens in this novel is the Prince of Salina engaging with this debate about can the south be changed by the north. So that whole section where he debates with Chevalli, the Piedmontese, who comes from Piedmont, from the north, saying you people come in with your ideas of changing Sicily. But Sicily is unchangeable, says Salina. And at that point, of course, we're made aware by the narrative that he's projecting onto Sicily what he himself thinks about his own dynastic existence. So Sicily, he speaks for Sicily. Sicily is unchangeable. So the only thing Sicilians want to do is to sleep, to remain constant, for the outsiders to leave them be. That's what Sicily is like. You are people from the north. You come in with these ideas of change, or in his words, to canalize Sicily into the mainstream of history, to drag Sicily into a form of history where everything is in motion, things are going forward, etc. The mistake that Garibaldi and the northern Italians make is in trying to harness Italy to the force of nature. For the Prince of Salina, that is impossible. And in doing so, of course, he's reiterating this commonsensical understanding between the difference of northern and southern Italy. So Rome is different from the rest of the peninsula, above all for their historic poverty and economic underdevelopment, their engagement in a clientelistic style of politics, and their cultural support for patriarchal gender relations for various manifestations of organized crime. Most famously, of course, the mafia. So one of the things that is tested out in this book by giving us the perspective of this beleaguered aristocrat who feels the times and the lands changing around him is the charge of this idea of the south of Italy being a fundamentally different continent. As you can see, Italians themselves in the 19th century debate this vigorously. Luigi Carlo Farini is talking about his visit to the south. This is not Italy, he says, this is Africa. Going back to what we already saw in the Spanish context with Baroja, African existence in the middle of Madrid. This is not Italy, this is Africa. Compared to these peasants, the Bedouins are the pinnacles of civilization, he says. And these are Italians writing about the difference between north and south. Alfred Morin, 1854, writes, gives a kind of chart of progression, the chart of historical regression, right? In Milan, in Turin, in the north, one finds modern society. So you can see the juxtaposition of time and space there. In the north of Italy, you have modern society, i.e. contemporary society. In Florence, it is like the time of the Medicis. As you come a little bit south to Umbria and Tuscany, you have regressed in time. You've gone back a few couple of centuries. You're in the Renaissance of the Medicis. In Rome, you come further south, you're immersed in the Middle Ages. In Naples, right at the south, we re-enter the pagan era. So you've left the Christian era behind. You re-enter paganism, move from there to Puglia into the Principality of Salerno, and the customs present themselves to you with all the naive simplicity of ancient times. So there's a kind of interesting paradox in that final sentence, the naive simplicity of ancient times. It's both a statement of rejection and desire. Right? In the ancient times, things weren't as complicated and as fraught as now. Naive simplicity, there's a sense of yearning there, but of course, it is already in the past, unless you are in Salerno, Naples, Sicily, etc., which coexist within the same historical framework as Turin and Milan, but they occupy a different time. So what you see here is an idea of a kind of coeval existence. Physically, they exist in the same time frame, but of course, in terms of historic existence, they're in a completely different era altogether. And this is exactly what Gramsci analyzes, the mindset that produces the reasons for what he sees as the historic underdevelopment of the south of Italy in his essay, The Southern Question. And for Gramsci, of course, this goes into the reasons of this underdevelopment is basically, I don't want to reduce him, is basically, I don't want to be reductive about him, but goes to the pattern of land holding and the internal colonization of Italy by the northern capitalists of the south. But, you know, we'll leave that be. The important thing here is the idea that southern history is basically different to the north. On the one hand, you have this constant, almost illogical, incomprehensible, volcanic eruptions of passion, political and otherwise. So in the novel, there's quite often the linkage between physical passion, erotics, and political passion is made clear, and made clear in a quite a detached, cool, ironic away. So Tancredi's political passion for the red shirts, for example, is on the one hand typical of the South, because suddenly Tancredi, who belongs to this aristocratic, if impoverished family, decides to side with the red shirts and escapes to the mountain and comes back with this new band. But so on the one hand, his behavior is shown to be unpredictable, like the volcanoes of the South. On the other hand, we are shown that it's a very calculated, shrewd move. As he tells the prince, if things are to remain the same, the things have to change, right? I have to pretend to be a liberal. I have to play this game if we are to retain our family privileges over time. It's a totally realistic or realist, cynical, a very politically shrewd move. So one of the things that Lampedusa questions here is the stereotype of southern volatility. The idea that people change all of a sudden out of no rhyme or reason at all is both shown and then deconstructed. Suddenly we see Tancredi not so much both as a product of the south, but also displaying a particular kind of cunning, shrewdness that is said to be typical of the historical man of the north. So he both plays up stereotypes and constantly undercuts them, shows them that there are other things going on. The human beings of the south may not be as elemental as they are shown to be usually. The other thing that suffuses the novel is, of course, the sense of mortality. At one point, Prince Salina thinks about these figures, the mummies that you'll famously see in Sicily, of corpses that are dried in the sun and hung out for display as a kind of memento mori, a kind of reminder that we'll all go that way. So one of the things, and the prince is, of course, by the end of the book, but chronologically in the middle of the book, so in the 1880s, is that beautiful chapter where he dies. That, in a way, is a kind of climax of this death consciousness. But one of the things that the novel shows us, that the prince's death consciousness is not a generalized phenomenon. So again, on the same, at one level, we have this kind of display of the kind of mortal consciousness, the consciousness that is said to suffuse Southern society at the, as a kind of flip side in a dialectical relationship with its extravagant sensuality. So sex and death go hand in hand in the South, we are told, in the terms of stereotypes. On the other hand, we are shown that people who inhabit those kinds of consciousnesses often do that as a matter of conscious strategy. The prince wants to believe in a form of death. Sleep, he says, is what Sicilians need. But of course, in the novel, we are shown other Sicilians who behave quite differently. Tancredi, for example, or Angelica, or Calogero Segada, Angelica's father. They don't want sleep. They definitely are looking forward to this new era and making the most of it. So one of the things we are given on the one hand are these old ideas of North and South, of Italy, of Europe, but on the other hand, those are immediately taken away and undercut by various multifocal, varied points of view that contradict those assumptions. That's Garibaldi's troop arriving in Naples and thereby dragging Naples into history is the implication. So some Sicilians, that's a 19th century painting. To some Sicilians, the arrival of the Thousand and their red shirts might signify a kind of death. And we are given a full representation of that consciousness, but not all Sicilians subscribe to that. So on the other hand, you have other Sicilians, the southern human beings, who are very much creatures of history, who very much swim with the historical tide. They do not inhabit that death consciousness, the consciousness of things ending that the prince does. So part of what Lampedusa wants to do in this novel is to give us this whole complex range of historical feelings at a very personal, individuated level. What does it feel like, if you are Salina, what does it feel like to inhabit the end of history? The fact that you and your like are already obsolete. On the other hand, Lampedusa also wants to capture, remember he's writing this in the aftermath of a devastating war, Second World War in Italy, where the South has made, not only has Italy sided disastrously with fascist Germany, fascist Italy has sided disastrously with Nazi Germany, but the post-war settlement has also been a particularly problematic one. For example, in Sicily, the Allied forces led by the Americans, have come to an understanding with the mafia, with the criminal clans, that the structures of power in Sicily won't be changed. So the Allied occupation won't do anything to disturb the hold of the criminal clientelistic structures of power there. So the various kinds of things have changed very quickly, and things have not at the same time. And that's what really, so that kind of peculiar nature of the transformation, where you think you've lived through a historical epoch where everything's changed, but as Tancredi says, some things have remained constant. That particular peculiarity is in some ways the structuring principle of the novel, which is why it's generic confusion. What kind of book is it? When it comes out in 57, 58, one of the things people find difficult to recognize, they find it hard to classify it. Is it a historical novel? Is it a memoir? Is it a modernist novel? What are these chapters about Abbe Pirone doing in a novel about the Prince of Salina? Why is this strange, long, 10-page account of Tancredi and Angelica getting lost in Donna Fugata's hidden corners, basically, which are sadomasochist chambers, if you remember those things, they're rambling through the palace where they're strangely stirred by these rooms where whips and nails and other instruments of torture are hidden away. What does that mean? How can you write a historical novel without telling us, giving us the story of the landing and the fate of the South? Why do you have a passage about 18th century sadomasochism in the middle of this, right? So one of the things that people find hard to come to terms with when it's published in 1950s, it's this generic confusion, generic proliferation. The Leopard generated much confusion. This is on your handout, Richard O'Mara's 2008 article. Out of what literary genre did the Leopard spring? Where does it belong? Who did Lampedusa emulate in his writing? Proust, Tolstoy, Pirandello, Stendhal? There are so many candidates, they cancel one another out. The difficulty of matching the novel with something familiar to the intelligentsia is perhaps the reason E.M. Forster, the British novelist, called it one of those lonely books. One of those lonely books that stand out in the history of literature. Taking us back to that pronouncement on the hunger artist, on Knut Hamsun's novel, about its startling originality. Suddenly, all familiar ways of writing fall away. You get this weird beast that has taken all kinds of generic codes from disparate traditions in order to capture the complexity of what people feel. What does it feel to be caught up in this time when everything changes and nothing does? That's the consciousness that the novel is trying to capture. In the novel, of course, one of the things that disturb people is this double consciousness. You see the Prince of Salina's consciousness, and then you step out of it. There's a kind of double vision where the narrator gives us all kinds of anachronistic similes. The idea of flying on a super jet between Palermo and Naples, for example, suddenly arriving in a novel about the 19th century. Where does that come from? Suddenly, the perspective of the narrator and the perspective and the consciousness of the narrator and the consciousness of Prince Salina are totally sundered. Again, they join together in the next sentence. So Don Fabrizio heard the proceedings. This is Eduardo Saccone writing in 1991, preceding rumbles of the times, but it was Lampedusa. So Don Fabrizio is the historical prince of Lampedusa on whom the novel is based. So he heard the preceding rumbles, but it was Lampedusa who lived in the time of the full social avalanche. Hence, a certain kind of disjunction and diffraction, a kind of double vision. The renunciation itself of the classical mode of continuous narration of the 19th century novel in favor of a narration, as Saccone says, by leaps and bounds. So one of the things that the novel avoids is giving us a sequential progression of the Salina household. We get a moment in 1860, we get a moment in 1880, we get a moment in 1910s. There are three kind of episodic moments that are wielded together, but not progressively. You jump back and forth in time. The novel itself, the passages themselves double back in both time and space, etc. So one of the things that the reason that Lampedusa employs this new double perspective, where you're simultaneously being propelled towards the future and being dragged back towards the past. What he's basically proposing is to write a family history that leads up to the moment of his own death in 1957, but the only way he can do that is to go constantly back and forth between the range of Garibaldi's landing and the moment, the final moments of the novel 1910s, where those relics, the dog Bendiccio, is finally laid to dust. We've looked at this passage before, and this basically is the logic that logic spelled out. So this is in that passage, if you remember, where the Princess Salina chides Chevalli, the Piedmontese, who've come to ask him to be a member of the Italian Senate. And the Prince of Salina refuses, and he says, "Why? Why do you? Don't you want to lead your country into the future?" And then he comes up with this rant that we have looked at before. "Do you really think, Chevalli, that you are the first who had hoped to canalize Sicily into the flows of universal history, etc.? For a long time to come, there is nothing to be done." That's his pronouncement, the idea of history ending in Sicily, nothing else to be done at all. But of course, that consciousness we're immediately made aware is only the Prince of Salinas. There are other people around him who have a very different vision, and what the novel tries to do is to go to capture both. What does it need to do to capture both? Is to write itself, to reinvent in some ways the form of the historical novel itself, where the perspective is doubled, where the narrative is disjunctured, where the flow of time is eruptive and disruptive. It goes back and forth without any particular, it seemingly without any particular direction. If you've seen the film, The Leopard with Burt Lancaster, Dan's playing the role of the Princess Selina, here about to embark on his dance with Angelica. And that scene becomes a kind of famous scene in cinema history, on par with the dance scene in Anna Karenina, A Ball in Anna Karenina. What this scene celebrates, of course, partly, is this feeling of nostalgia, where a whole order of being is, these people are dancing, as it were, when their time is up. History has left them behind. This whole class, it's a bit like, this is why that final scene, despite the kind of saccharine treatment of Titanic's ending, still resonates. Not the film Titanic, the historical event Titanic's ending. The idea of dancing while you drown to that last music going on. This is why that still carries a certain kind of power despite the best efforts of Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio, right? The idea that in the face of annihilation, what you're celebrating is like a last defiance against oblivion. On the other hand, of course, the reality of this dance is very different. Angelica, in fact, is being accepted into the ancient family of the Salinas. There are new kinds of alliances being made between Tancredi and Angelica, and by the time we reach the chapter of called The Relics, we realize that a new Italy, in fact, has been born. It's not perfect. It has gone, and certainly the power has been captured by elements of the old ruling classes in alliance with people like Angelica's father. So in fact, this dance scene, on the one hand, may be a kind of gesture of final defiance against oblivion, but it's also a scene that celebrates and welcomes these new compromises, where Don Caligari-Segada appears as the book says, as this bourgeois revolution in tales, when he remember when he appears with a very badly made evening suit to the party given by the leopard. That, the Prince of Salina says, was equivalent for him to the news of Garibaldi landing. That really is the sign of time. So this dance scene becomes key both for celebrating this kind of tragic defiance against a whole way of life passing. On the other hand, at the same moment, it consummates, it puts the seal on these new troubling times where various compromises are made to ensure some kind of continuity. And that is the double vision that Lampedusa wants to capture in order, and in order to capture that, what will have to change and yet remain the same is the form of the historical novel itself. Okay, off you go. Next couple of weeks, Graham's going to return to northern climates and temperatures with, actually one of them is in Hungary and it's pretty hot. The final one is the Atom Station in Iceland. So Skylark and Atom Station.